My name's Bob Darrow and I am alcoholic. When it says in the book that lack of power is my dilemma, I find it interesting that there's a searching and a seeking of power in all three areas of the inventory. Resentments always gave me an illusion of power as I would grind away and have conversations in my head about what I'm going to do to them and what I'm going to say to them. And as I would churn away inside myself with the resentment, I would have this illusion of power that I'm going to do something. I'm going to be significant. But in actuality, I'm more like one of those puffer fishes that blows up and does nothing. Right? My fears that I could, this illusion that if I worry about something enough, that I will have power over it or control over it. I had a guy that I sponsored one time. He said something funny to me. He said, you know, you guys in AA are always talking about we shouldn't worry, it's stupid, it doesn't work. He says, I think worrying works because I look back and I don't think that there's anything I ever worried about that's actually happened.
Isn't that the truth?
And sex, I think, also is about power. I think the problem with sex is a lack of power. Over the years, if I get a phone call at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning from someone I sponsor and they are in very serious trouble and they're on the verge of drinking again or committing murder or suicide, it's usually involving a relationship. And why would that be? You know, there's a line in the book that says, when we treat sex like any other problem, well, God, at times it seems like it's a bigger deal. In the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, Wilson talks about the three basic instincts that drive us. And he indicates that he believes, and relating back to chapter 5, where he says we're extreme examples of self-will run riot, though we usually don't think so. Then, you know, in the 12 by 12, he implies that we take these three basic instincts that everybody has to some degree, and we take them to extremes, absurd extremes. And the three instincts are the instinct for sex. Alcoholics take that to extremes. I had a dear friend, Scott, used to say, he says, alcoholic guys, he said, they don't look at porno, they end up in the burn unit. I mean, it's like, right, they take it to real extremes. I mean, we do everything alcoholically. And the other instincts are security. And Bill talks about the 12 by 12, the two types of security, emotional security and material security. And then the third basic instinct is the instinct for society. Our obsessive preoccupation on how we look to others and how we fit socially. And in relationships is the one venue where all three of those instincts can either be enhanced or threatened. If you're in a long-term relationship, and it starts going south on you, it is the one area of your life where your emotional security is threatened, your financial security is threatened, your position in society is threatened, because I don't know anyone that wants to go to their family, their neighbors, their home group, and say, I failed. I'm going through a divorce. No one wants to do that. And if those of you who have ever had breakups in recovery, it's a bizarre thing. You just ended a relationship, and it seems like every meeting you go to is full of happy couples. What's that about? It's just bizarre. and then and security, both material and emotional security, society and sex. They're all threatened. And the greater the propensity for fear, the greater propensity for spiritual sickness. And Wilson in step 7 talks about the chief activator of all our defects is self-centered fear. So the arena with the most possible threat is the greatest potential for fear is the greatest potential to make me sick inside. And so that's why we anguish so much. There's a paragraph in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions in step 4 where it just starts off about, it says, from our twisted relationships, we've suffered the most. And it's a whole paragraph about how these have made us sick over the years in our lives. And so we start trying to take an honest and genuine look at this area of our life. And one of the things that it says going into it, and I think this is good news for a lot of us, is that we don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We don't. As you'll see as we get into the inventory, it's not even about sex. It's not this. There's nothing in here about sex. It's about selfishness. It's about dishonesty. It's about self-seeking. It's about self-centered inconsideration. It's about manipulating others through jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness, or enhancing your own fears through arousing those things. It's not. It's about manifestations of self. I often think it would be more, fifth steps would be more interesting if it actually was about sex. I mean, but it's not. I mean, it's not. So, what do? It says we reviewed our conduct over the years past. So I always tell the guys I sponsor, just let's make a list again, just like we did in fears and we did in resentments. Let's make a list. Go back through your life. Any place where the sexual instincts were aroused, list it. Put it down. Put that relay. Even if you didn't consummate, if you were in action with that. Because we're trying to see how self manifests and shows up when it comes to relationships. So list all your relationships. And then there's 9 questions. In each relationship, I ask myself, first of all, where had I been selfish? Now, when you read chapter 5 about selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our troubles, and you look at this in a general way, that's one thing. But when you list every relationship you've had in your life, and then you see in every case your own selfishness, it's almost overwhelming. One of the things I started realizing, oh my God, I used to dress it up like I was so kind and I was so giving, but in actuality, I'm a me first person. When I was kind or loving or affectionate, wasn't it, if you peeled away the layers of the onion, wasn't it really self-serving? Because I was because I didn't want to lose you. I wanted to get laid. I wanted your attention. I wanted your approval. I wanted your affection. I want. And I really was a me first person. And you look at it, you see in every case, again, and again, and again, and again. And oh my God, I'm not the kind and loving person I always fancied myself to be. I hid it. Where was I dishonest? Well, I think our level of dishonesty is almost pathological when it comes to relationships. It's not even a conscious dishonesty. It's delusional. Driven, it seems, driven by these vacancies for security, this idea that I'm going to find with this person, after we get all the kinks ironed out in this relationship, surely then, through my management and working this the right way, I will have found the power to put all my lonely, empty places aside. and fill up the little empty, squirmy places in my life. I will surely have found the power to make myself feel valid and whole and complete. Did you ever see the movie Jerry Maguire? That movie messed up 10,000 people in this country. There was a scene in the elevator, and oh my God, I remember I was sitting in the movie theater, and there's this deaf couple, they're talking, and they're doing sign language, and the guy says to the girl, what did he say? And she's almost in tears. She says, he said, you complete me. And all the women in the audience went, oh. Well, what does that mean? That's an old idea that has disaster written all over it. What you're really saying is that your vacancies can be filled by another human being. And if you come at relationships from that self-seeking, self-serving, selfish point of view, as if you're going to complete me, you're going to end up pissed at the person you're with, because you cannot fill inside vacancies we all are burdened with filling our own vacancies, and there's only one thing that fills that. And every guy I've ever sponsored, they got sober, single, sober. They're 3 months, probably 2 months, maybe. They feel the emptiness, and it looks to them like a relationship-shaped hole. They become obsessed. It's just, they start, the radar comes on. They go to meetings, they're tracking. She with anyone. I mean, it's just, it's like crazy. Right? What's your primary purpose? Helping new guys. Where's she with? Who's she with? Who's she with? Who's she with? I mean, no, right? It's like, oh, God. And we don't know it. And we don't even know we're doing that sometimes, you know? It's just almost a natural deal. What happens, driven by these fears, I become dishonest with people. Alcoholics lie a lot, and it looks like we're liars, but we're not. We don't lie because we're liars. We lie because we're afraid. I lie and misrepresent myself and enhance who I am because of an old belief that as is, you're probably not going to love me. You know why? Because I know me better than anybody, and I'm not too big on me. And I always secretly believed if you knew everything about me that I know about me, you'd probably end up feeling about me like I feel about me. And let's not have that happen. So I lie. I misrepresent myself. And it's not an outward lie. It's not a big lie. It's little tweakings of reality. What I do is here's Bob. I'll introduce you to Bob. But this isn't all of Bob. This is the best of Bob on his best day on steroids, Bob. Right? This is the best of Bob. You get the best of Bob. But let's keep the other, let's keep the, anything that might be, let's keep, you don't want, no, yeah. The problem is you can't maintain that. And what we do is we write checks we can't cash. We misrepresent ourselves. And then it always happens, doesn't it? Eventually, you can't maintain the facade, or you get comfortable enough in the relationship that you think you're home free, and then you start letting the guards down, and then you always hear the same thing. The one person will go to their sponsor and they'll go, they've changed. No, they didn't. That's the real them. You just haven't met them before. And we don't even know we do this, I think. We misrepresent ourselves out of fear, because I'm too afraid that if I let you know who I am from the very start, that you couldn't possibly love me. So we enhance ourselves and tweak our our representation of ourselves, and it's just a little bit disingenuous. I heard this story probably 30 years ago about this guy and this gal in AA, and they've been sober. They got sober about the same time, within a week or two of each other, and they just turned a year, and they had been told not to get involved with another member of the opposite sex for a year. And here's the part of the story it's hard to believe. They actually followed that through. I know that's hard to believe. But they actually went a year. But they're over ready. You know what I mean? You know what over ready looks like? You've seen people in your home group, they're over ready. I mean, they're over ready. They're like that dog in the Alpo commercials that they don't feed for about 3 weeks and they bring them out on the stage, you know, over ready. Well, they've been looking, they started tracking each other across the home group, making eyes at each other, and then they kind of bump into each other conveniently at the coffee break, and you just go into heat. Now, I love being around people in AA that go into heat. You can get a suntan standing around them. It's wonderful. They go into heat, and they start dating, and they're in that infatuation stage. When Huey Lewis in the news did a song about "I Need a New Drug," it's just like that, isn't it? It's like when you're in that infatuation stage, it's like you took something. I mean, your perception of reality is altered. I mean, she's so bright. She's perfect. And the sky's bluer than it's ever been. And you tell your sponsor things like, "I know now that God loves me." You know, I mean, you just feel that. Oh my God, it don't get any better than that. It's just amazing. Amazing. Well, they start living together, and they get engaged, and about, a little while goes by, and he says to her one day while they're still in the infatuation stage, he says, "What are you doing on Sunday?" She says, "Oh, I don't know. What are you doing?" And he says, "Well, the big football game's on, the playoffs, and I thought, I don't know if you like football, but maybe if you did, we could sit and watch the game together." And she said, "Oh my God, I'd love to do that. I love that. That's great." Well, the truth is, she hates football. But in the infatuation stage, she would go to a rock fight with this guy. You know what I'm saying? Right? I'd be glad to do it. Well, a year later, they're living together, they're getting ready to get married, and the infatuation stage is worn off. And he says to her, she says to him, "Sunday, I want you to come with me to the mall. We need to get some drapes and some stuff for their apartment." And he says, "Oh, no, sweetheart, not Sunday. The big game's on. We can sit and watch the game." And she starts yelling at him, "You still watch that goddamn football? I hate that football." And he's looking at her like, "Who are you? Did aliens steal my girlfriend? I mean, where?" And she never consciously tried to deceive him. When she said, "Oh, I'd love to," she wanted to love to, but she didn't. And that is the essence of self-delusion. It's psychotic wishful thinking. It's that she wanted to like football, but she didn't like football. And guys do the same thing. Guys are worse, I think. There's a moment with guys that when a guy's been dating a girl for a while and they haven't actually had sex yet, but they're at that night where they're, you know, the stars have lined up and you're about to. There's a moment during that where a woman could say to a guy, "Sweetheart, before we go any further, do you really, really love me and want to spend the rest of your life with me?" And the guy, in all honesty to himself, will go, "Yes, yes." And then he wonders, and then the next day she shows up with the U-Haul, and one wonders, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. But you said, yeah, I did, didn't I?"
Didn't I?
See, when he says, yes, I really love you and want to spend the rest, at that moment he wants to believe that. It's not a constant conscious deception. No more than the girl is when she said, I'd love to watch football with you. It's that psychotic, delusional, wishful thinking that is spurred, I think, by our own vacancies. Our own driven by our own need not to be alone. These instincts that Bill talks about in the 12 steps and 12 traditions. And it says, and where was I inconsiderate? I'll tell you, just in the last few years, I really, and this has been a piece of business in my sixth and seventh step for quite a few years, because I get these glimpses. I'm just so self-centered. I exhibit what appears to be in consideration, and it is, but it's not conscious. It's just I'm so wrapped up in what I got going on, I don't see you. And it happens all the time in relationships. I have a guy that I sponsor who's been married a long time, and he loves his wife, and he's got a big corporate job, and he has to go to a lot of fancy dinners and stuff, and it's very, very important for him not only to be on time but to be early. And so he goes, they're going and getting dressed up to go out to some fancy event. And, they have to leave the house at 7 o'clock. And at 7:05, she's all ready and she's ready to come downstairs. And so they can be on time. And she walks by the mirror and she goes, oh, no, that dress doesn't work. And starts all over again. And makes him late every single time. She's not setting out consciously, maliciously, or selfishly to hurt him. But it happens what she can't see past the need to make this look right when she looks in the mirror. Guys do the same thing all the time. I had a situation of probably 18. So it's been 15 years. I was dating Gal Terry, and we were at the Las Vegas Roundup, which is a big convention that I was a past chairman of, and I'm really connected to that conference back in those days. I was on the committee for a lot of years. A lot of my friends from out of town come there. I'm very, very excited to go. I'm with my date, who could care less. She's just trying to go. She's just on a date with her boyfriend. It doesn't matter. She's not that enthusiastic about being there. And we're in this hospitality room, a room that's not too much unlike this, a little bit longer. There's two entrances, one on each end. I'm standing with her in front of the one entrance. My friends, John and Mary Emma Holmes, come down through the other entrance, and I hadn't seen John in a while. And John had been very important to me over my sobriety. I went and stayed at his house at a very hard time from my sobriety in 11th year. John's important to me. When I saw him walk in to that room, I got very lit up. I was just like you do with someone who's been very important and you hadn't seen for a while. And I was so excited to see him. I ran down, I gave him a hug, and oh my God, how are you doing? I'm so glad to see you. Now that is my reality. My date's reality, on the other hand, is her boyfriend left her standing all by herself in the corner of a room as he ran away from her to be with his friends. Now, I didn't even know I did that. Later, I knew all about how I did that. I knew more about how I did that than I ever imagined I needed to know later, I'm telling you. But it's hurtful. And it feels like the person is just dissing you and being inconsiderate. And if you're an alcoholic, you may not even know you're doing that. The problem is selfishness and self-centeredness, is that I can't see past myself enough to see you. I see what's going on in me, but I can't see how it's affecting you. And these are, this is another area I'm asleep at. I'm asleep at the wheel. And I just in the last couple years, I've found, you know, it's funny, you get do-overs here. And you'll find yourself in a situation, and all of a sudden you get it. And you see, you get it. You're, now there's no inconsistency. You get it. You get what's going on. You see the other person. You see everything. And you realize I was in the same situation a while back, and I didn't get it. Not out of malice, and not even stupidity. I can't see past myself. And so I have seen it personally. This is an area that I very struggle with a lot, and I've seen a lot of progress just in the last couple of years. Whom had I hurt? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? I can do that in my partner, and that's a form of manipulation. I remember my old home group, I used to see this Thursday nights at the big meetings sometimes. There'd be these couples would come there, and the guy would go off and talk to some of the newer guys and be involved with a bunch of the guys, and the girl wasn't doing that. She'd get aggravated that all of a sudden she's not getting enough attention. So what I saw this on a couple of occasions, she'd start being very flirtatious with one of his friends or another guy in the group to bring his attention back to her. And that is a very divisive and harmful thing to do, because it creates resentments, it creates separation, it creates disunity. And it's a form of manipulation. And sometimes I know that we've all, to some degree, done this in ourselves, where I will obsess so much on my fears and jealousy that it'll make me crazy. And I'll unjustifiably arouse it in myself, where I just start focusing on things. So you can drive yourself so crazy, you'll be the guy that's driving by her apartment in the middle of the night, peeking in the windows to make sure no guys are there. I mean, you can make yourself insane with this, arousing this stuff in yourself. Feeding the dog that should be starved. And why is all this? Well, it's all fear-based. And what's the answer to fear? Trusting in God. When I'm aroused in jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness, I wouldn't suppose I would have much trust in God, would I? And then the great question. Where was I at fault, and what should I have done instead? I think that this is the paramount question here. And the reason I believe that is that there's a tremendous amount of redemption built into the fabric of the universe. We all get do-overs here. We all get do-overs. Everyone I know, their story in sobriety is second and third and fourth chances. You screwed up in your first marriage, and you look back and you shudder, and you were so selfish, and you were so you can't even believe you're that way. You get a do-over in your next one. And if you learn and know what you could have done instead, then you've got a way to go. You have a vision that you can bring some grace into to carve a new road in your life. But if you don't have any idea of what you should have done instead, what usually happens when emotions are in play is you'll repeat the same thing over again. That's why sexual inventories are, there's a sameness in them. I mean, it's like you get about halfway through listening to a guy, and he starts saying things like, and it's the same here, and I have the same selfish, and the same, because it's like a wagon wheel on a dirt rut, on a dirt road. It always finds the rut. It's the path of least, it's the path that gravity brings you into. And that's what happens to a lot of us. We end up repeating the same things because when our emotions are in play and we don't know what else to do, we do what we did before. The Irish say that the devil we know is better than the devil we don't, but you gotta find one you don't. You gotta find something new here. And so what could I have done instead? I watched some wonderful do-overs in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have some friends that, admittedly, by their own stories, they talk about how they were horrid parents. And they were horrid, drunken parents who abused their children. And they carry a lot of shame with that. And those people get to be some of the most loving and brilliant grandparents. That's their do-over. There is redemption made into the foundation of the universe. We always get a way to go. But I think I have to be awake to it, because if I'm not, I'm going to miss it. It's going to come up. The opportunity is going to present itself. Maybe it's an employment. Maybe you were a terrible, selfish, self-centered employee who only ever thought about yourself and you stole from your boss. You'll get another job eventually. You'll get another chance for redemption. Not only do you get a chance to go back to that boss or back to that ex or back to that whatever and make amends, but you get a chance to do it over and do it different if you learn from the past. And so we ask ourselves, what should I have done instead? We got this all down on paper. We looked at it. In this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. And if you're new, that might be a promise that you might have a future sex life. That's a, there's hope here. I see 4 or 5 guys underlining that in the book. Future sex life. Yes, yes, future. Future sex life. When? An hour from now? No, I don't know. We subjected each relationship to this test. This is the great test. Was it selfish or not? I will spend the rest of my life looking for manifestations of the problem and evidence of the solution. I will spend the rest of my life looking for the resurgence of selfishness and dishonesty and self-seeking and self-pity and fear, and also at the same time noticing the hand of God and being grateful for the grace and the blessings that have come in. As I become, wake up more and more to the problem, and I wake up more and more to the presence of the solution that had always been there. God's grace, you'll hear at meetings all the time about people will look back, even in their drinking, and they'll see the hand of providence, how they just missed, how come my car, if it would have been 1 foot over, I'd been dead, and they would have been dead. And all the coincidences that line up to bring us to Alcoholics Anonymous. Almost as if there was something even working against our natural destructive tendencies to get us, trying to get us here. Trying to get us here, in spite of ourselves. And we become more and more aware of God's hands in our life, and more aware of the ego's predominance and how it never goes away, and it keeps reoccurring. We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. That's a novel thought for some of us. If any of you have come from strong fundamental religion, when you're a child, they don't talk about God, sex being a God-given thing. They almost imply like it comes from Satan or something. I mean, it's something dirty and despised, despicable, and you do it in the dark with someone you love, which will set you up for some bizarre relationships. That it's God-given, but there's a responsibility. Every gift has a responsibility, not to be used lightly. It can't be used selfishly. There has to be consideration. There has to be consciousness with every gift. We get that in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't we, in the traditions. We're given a tremendous amount of freedom here with autonomy. But with the autonomy comes responsibility, hopefully gained through an awakening to what our actions speak to the rest of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can do anything you want here, but everything you do here speaks something of you, and it speaks something to the new people. It's your vote on how everybody else should act. Isn't that odd? And I'm a funny kind of guy. I think a lot of us are like this. I believe in the rules. I believe that there are certain principles that should apply to everyone. I just think my case is different. I think the 55-mile-an-hour speed zone is real. That's a good law, man. I mean, we could have chaos if we didn't have it on the highways. A lot of people would be killed. It's a good law, but I'm in a hurry. I think handicapped parking is a good thing, man. We should have it. I mean, those handicapped people need to be able to get in and out of places. They shouldn't have to walk a long distance. It's a good thing, but I'm in a hurry. I'll only be a minute. Right? As if the ego of the alcoholic feels he's above the rules. We're hard on other people, keeping them. But our case is special. And that's not the truth. So whatever I do in Alcoholics Anonymous is going to somehow be an example to the people that are newer than I am and the people I will end up sponsoring. Some days, and none of us are perfect here, we all have feet of clay. There are days in Alcoholics Anonymous I feel like I'm a pretty good example. There are other days I just want to apologize all the time. And I wish I was a better example. But we all struggle towards the light. And the last thing I'm going to talk about, I'll turn it over to Sheldon, is it says if sex becomes troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into work helping others. It says something interesting. It says it quiets the imperious urge. Just in the last couple of days, I've been thinking, I want to look that word up, imperious. Because I'm thinking, does that come from the root word, the same word as imperial, like king? Imperious urge, or is it something else? I don't know. But I know one thing for sure from my experience, when relationships become difficult and they're really on you and you're in a lot of pain, reading the big book doesn't help. You can't remember 10 seconds after you read a paragraph what you just read. Praying doesn't help, because you'll, in the middle of the prayer, you'll be saying, God, please help me to stay sober. I hope they die in a fire accident. And just, it bleeds in there. I mean, it's just, you know, you can't help it. There's only one thing that works. When the fog of self has just come down and you can't see nothing, is you need a seeing-eye newcomer to walk you out of the fog. Thanks, Sheldon.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sheldon.
That last bit that Bob was talking about, where it talks about it quietens the imperious urge. The rest of that sentence I read wrong for a long time. What I read that to mean was that if I have a problem with sex conduct, or as Bob said in that section, it says we treat sex as we would any other problem. So if I have an issue in my life in any area, it says I should throw myself the harder into working with new people. And it says when to yield would cause heartache. And I read that wrong for so long. I thought it meant when to take the action to do the bad behavior would cause me problems in my life. So instead of doing those, what I do is I go work with a new guy to distract my attention, to get this seeing eye newcomer. I love that phrase you use. To lead me away from the problem, because if I was to do the behavior, it may cause me harm. But that's not what it says. It says when to yield would cause heartache. Because for me, not to do the behaviors that are self-destructive is not always easy. Sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to do the easy thing, but that's not what we talk about here. We talk about the next right thing. Sometimes to do the next right thing is difficult here. And sometimes to yield causes heartache. But I'm self-obsessed and I only care about how I feel. And so I say crazy things like, well, I'm not ready to give that up yet because I don't feel right about it. I mean, I have that here. I have it here. Here I know I shouldn't be doing that. But it hasn't taken that long journey to here yet. And what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is the time that it takes that journey, when that happens, is when I allow the yielding to cause heartache and the seeing I newcomer to take it from here to here, and that's my experience. So we've completed our four steps. We've done all three lists, and we're done with our four steps. So now what I understand you're supposed to do, and one of my biggest resentments against Bob is that I never got to do this. What you're supposed to do now is take that out to a beautiful place, a mountain vista, somewhere with trees, perhaps on a day like today, which to you guys, you probably look at the snow and think it's ugly by now, but to me, the snow-capped trees, build a bonfire, right? So you have a beautiful glow of the orange fire to keep warm by. And perhaps play some Indian flute music. Get in some kind of a meditation position, perhaps the lotus position if you can. It's another one of my resentments that I'm unable to sit cross-legged, but it would be nice to do that too. And then set a flame to your false step and, as the ashes take into away goes all of the harms that you've done. I recommend against that, because one of the last things that it says on here is that we've begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past. So we're going to need to keep that list intact for future steps. And one of the things that we're going to need to keep it intact for is what we're going to talk about next in our fifth step. I don't want to do a fifth step. I think most guys who have a problem with a fourth step really isn't the problem so much with the fourth step. It's the problem with the fifth step. I mean, I'm not really much of a street guy. Some of you guys, I can tell by looking at you, some of you guys ran the streets years longer than you should have by the looks of some of you. I'm not much of a street guy, but I spent enough time running the streets to know the three rules of the street. Deny, deny, deny. Right? It wasn't me, I wasn't there, I didn't do it. You can't prove it. Right? There was a great song not long ago on the radio about some guy that got caught by his girlfriend, and he was with the girl, and the girlfriend guy, it wasn't me. And it's bad enough when they want you to write the inventory. I remember, I don't know if you guys watched that show, The First 48 Hours. You guys ever see that show? That's a great show. I love that show. Towards about halfway through the show, or towards the end of the show, they've done the good cop, bad cop routine a little bit, and they've gotten the guy where he's ready to admit to the problem, right? And they slide the yellow notepad across the table to him for him to write his confession. When I first saw him do that, I thought, my God, they may as well write resentments at the top of that thing. Looked just like the notepad my sponsor gave me when he told me to write my name. But the idea of me confessing anything is a bad idea. I mean, the idea of me telling you what's gone in me. And I'm funny. I don't know if you're like this. Some of the things in my life I'm happy and eager to talk about. Sometimes in meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, early in sobriety and even later into sobriety, when people are sharing about stuff, one guy will share about some criminal activity he did, and I'll get excited, you know? And I may have done something, never anything quite as bad as that, but I want to share the thing that I did, right? And I want to embellish it. I want to make it sound bigger and riskier and scarier than what I might have done. I don't know if it's really the big stuff that I'm so afraid of. But I don't want you to know about how pathetic I am. I don't want you to know about my little resentments and my judgments and the things that I think and the things I'm afraid of. And I don't want you to know what I think of me. I don't want you to know my little fears. I don't want you to know that I don't think I add up to much. I don't want you to know that I don't think I measure up. I don't want you to know that I don't feel on my insides the way you look on your outsides. I don't want you to know that I feel separate and alone and apart from. And I've written this inventory, and I'm starting to get a glimpse of some of the stuff about me, and I don't want you to know that. So I don't want to finish my Falstaff. I'm the guy that you call and you, how you doing with your Falstaff? I'm working on my Falstaff. Right? It's the biggest lie in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you have a pen in your hand? Well, no. Well, then you're not working on your Falstaff. I want to talk about doing a Falstaff as well. Philosophy, I want to share about what it might be like to do a Falstaff. And I think that a lot of it is this fear of sharing this stuff. I grew up in England, and in England they use that phrase, stiff upper lip. You got to pull your socks up, kid. Don't let anybody know. Don't let anybody know how you feel. If you're going to let anybody know how you feel, tell us in the house, but don't, whatever you do, don't ever take your garbage outside this house. You don't let them see you sweat. I grew up in England, but I grew up watching John Wayne. I know what it means to be a man. And it means to act tough and to suck it up and to keep it in. And I don't want you to know nothing about me. But at the end of the day, what is it that is killing me? Now, when I'm new, I don't have the words to tell you this. It comes with hindsight. It comes from being in AA for a little while. But the thing that's hurting me the most is that I feel alone. I feel disconnected. I feel cut off. I feel by myself. I feel like if either you're humans or I'm human, but we're not both the same thing, right? I just feel like I'm a fish out of water. And it's no surprise that that's the way I feel when I've spent my life building a wall between you and I. I've spent my life creating defense mechanisms that admittedly don't work very well, but defense mechanisms nonetheless that are designed to keep you at arm's reach, that are designed to keep me safe, yet really are the things that are building the wall that are causing me the most pain, that anxious apartness, that aloneness that I feel. So I come to my sponsor with this fifth step written, prepared to share this stuff. The book says that this requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. Now, why another human being? Right? Couldn't it be enough for me to have this inventory and for me to share it just with God? I mean, I'm not even sure I really believe in him yet, but if I do, it's a God of my own understanding and he loves me. The problem is with just me and God is that I have an ability to tell myself lies that nobody else believes and for me to act like they're true. I've been doing this all my life. I've been doing this in relationships and friendships at work. I've been doing this all my life. You ever done this? You ever convinced yourself of something that is absolutely not true, and then you believe it, and now you have to spend all the time you can persuading the people in your life that it's true. And they look at you like you're crazy, because it's clearly not true. But I've sold myself the lie. I can sell myself the lie that it's okay for me to drink. I can sell myself the lie that it's okay for me to flirt with those girls. I can sell myself the lie it's okay for me to gamble. I can tell myself the lie that my boss deserves to be told where to stick it. I can tell myself the lie that I am my first and best audience. And so for me to do an inventory with just me and God, God loves me. And he knows I don't want to hear it, and he's going to keep it. He and I together, I don't have the hotline. I'm not going to hear him. But I get with another person who's on this journey with me. And it's happened when I've been sharing fifth steps, and it's happened when I've been hearing fifth steps. I've experienced when somebody has said something to me of an inventory, about something that I know nothing about. I know nothing about. I don't have the backstory. I don't know them well enough. And it's on a topic or a subject that I've never had that particular situation in my life. And I'll be moved to say something to them, and they will look at me like, oh my God, how did you know? Because it seems like when there's another person in the room, God has the ability to use that person to carry that message. It's happened to me where I've been sharing an inventory, and I've said something, and the person that I'm sharing that inventory with has had some insight to say something to me, and when they've given me that direction, I've almost felt foolish, because it was so obvious. It was so clear. I mean, how on earth I could have not seen that? I don't know. But that somehow when we get together, the two of us get together for the spirit of recovery, that God is able to come into the room and communicate things through that other person. And sometimes it's collaborative. Sometimes I'm talking to my sponsor, I'm talking to a guy I sponsor, and I'll say something to them, and I'll be wrong. But it will get them to say, yeah, but what about this? And then together, God will move the conversation together. And we will discover something that we could, neither of us could have found out on our own. That if they'd have emailed in their fifth step, that I couldn't have emailed back my suggestions, because the two of us had to be in the room together for us to find the thing that God was trying to help us find. This is perhaps difficult, especially in discussing our defects with another person. We think that we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves, but there is doubt. In actual practice, we usually find solitary self-appraisal insufficient. We'll be more reconciled, the book says, in discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reason why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we might not overcome drinking. I have seen this a lot with guys that are gals that are in the middle of writing a false step. They'll look like they're doing everything. They'll look like they're doing, they're coming to the meeting, they're a member of the home group, they're stacking chairs, they're going to the meetings on a regular basis, they're checking in with you, they're calling you every day. You get them to start on their fourth step, and somehow they fizzle out before their fifth step. And they look like they're doing everything else in Alcoholics Anonymous. But they don't do the inventory. They don't do this piece of the work, and they fizzle out, and they drink. I sponsored a guy, this goes back 10 years. This is a guy that was in and out and in and out in our group. And he was a guy that Bob had sponsored, and our other friend Craig had sponsored, a couple other guys had sponsored. And finally he asked me to sponsor him, and he'd never done a fourth step. And I got him to that step. I got him to write a fourth step. And, finally I knew that it was through good, he finally had good sponsorship. I made sure that Bob and everybody knew, by the way, I got him to write an inventory. And he shared his fifth step with me, and I felt like it was a good inventory. Top of 73, they took inventory right, but they hung on to some of the worst items in stock. He didn't tell me everything. And he would come to me, and it was the strangest thing. He would come to me after a meeting or before a meeting, and he'd come up to me, and he'd have this look on his face of absolute, I don't know, consternation. Just this. And he'd say, "Shelburne," and he couldn't even talk. He'd stutter. I gotta talk to you. I gotta talk to you. Say, "Shel, what is it?" Because when somebody says that, you gotta know what they're gonna say, because it just seems like it's gonna be good, And he'd say, "Forget it." And he'd walk away. And I was bummed for two reasons. One, because I really wanted to help him, and two, because I know I just missed something juicy. But I talked to Bob, and I talked to a couple of the other guys that had worked with this guy, and they go, "Yeah, he did the same thing to us. He did the same thing to us." And he was doing, this guy, the day he drank, this is pretty rare this happens, but this happens, the day he drank, that morning he picked a guy up, a new guy up, and he had driven with him to a detox meeting not to take him to detox to be a patient, but for the two of them to take a panel into a detox. They'd gone to a detox meeting. He had talked to me. He'd called me and we chatted. Some of the things that he had shared with me on his fifth step that had turned into amends, he had made some of those amends. But if you only clear the blockage part of the way, there's still a blockage. If you only clear the blockage halfway, it's still blocked. My own personal experience with my fifth step, it talks about at the end of the fifth step portion, it talks about how we go home for an hour and we check to see if the work is solid so far. So my experience when I did my fifth step, we were at a conference in Scottsdale, and Bob had spoke at that conference, and that Saturday night, this is how good of a guy he is. He was willing to miss the dance to listen to part of my fifth step. So he's very magnanimous. And he missed... we missed the dance, and we went back to the room, and we finished my fifth step. When we were done, Bob, I don't think he missed the whole dance. I think he went to some of the dance. He's not that good. He went to some of the dance. And I couldn't go to the dance. I went to a marathon meeting. You know, they had the marathon meetings all through the conference. They sat in the meeting, and I just wasn't good. I had some expectations that I'd be done with my fifth step, and I would feel good, and I wasn't good. I was still sick. Well, the next morning, I get up, and... it's Sunday morning, and we're going to the spiritual meeting. And Bob looks at me, and I just must have had this look on my face, because he said, "My God, what didn't you tell me?" And I told him what I didn't tell him, and what I didn't tell him wasn't big stuff, but it was embarrassing. It was pathetic. It was squirmy stuff. That I didn't want to tell him, because I thought that if I told him that about me, that it was what I judged me for. It was the thing that, you know, I could live with just about everything else about me, but I couldn't live with that about me. And I knew that he would probably go, "What?" That's why I don't have contact lenses, because it's very difficult to go, "What?" Like this. It's just, it's for effect, right? But I told him that stuff, and he didn't react that way. He just kind of said, "That's no big deal. I'm glad you told me." And then you talk about creeper week, boy. It was what happened to me over the next few days, few weeks, was unbelievable. That when I had opened my soul to another human being, and therefore, and this is weird, because I wanted to get connected to God, but I didn't know how. I could not have prayed properly to get to connected to God. I wouldn't have known the words to say or the mental attitude to have. It would have been impossible for me to connect with God on my own. And so I didn't. I connected with my sponsor. And through connecting with my sponsor, I got connected with God as a result, without knowing it, without trying to. But over the next few weeks or months, the only thing that I can tell you that happened to me is that I got connected to God. Because I felt a closeness to my sponsor. I felt a trust with my sponsor. It did make me feel like I had more of a bond with my sponsor. I think with my sponsor it made him want to go wash his hands. But with me, I had that feeling, right? But through that and with that and because of that, I was able to connect with God also. So I was lucky. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I met a guy that early on that was to be my sponsor. I was about 4 days sober when I met Bob, and he's been my sponsor ever since. But that's not everybody's story. There are some people in Alcoholics Anonymous who maybe you've been going in and out for a while. Maybe you haven't found the right person to hear your inventory. So who do you go to? How do you find the person that you can, as it says in the bottom of page 73, we must be entirely honest with someone if we expect to live long and happily in this world. Which, by the way, it said earlier on, the best reason first, that is that we may not overcome drinking if we don't. But it implies there's a second reason. And that's the second reason. That if I'm not willing to do this inventory and I don't get completely honest with someone and I don't get free where I can be connected and I can be plugged in the way that I describe, I won't expect to, I can't expect to either live long, and that's the I might drink again, or happily in this world. And we've all met those guys, guys that stay sober. You know, so my story is that I can't stay sober without the work in AA. I'm 3 to 10 days and I drink again. But there are people, and maybe some in the room today, that are able to not drink and not do the work. Right, they're the ones, if you want what we have, God damn it, you just wouldn't want to, God. They're just not very happy, right? They're just, you just, sometimes you want to think, do you want to drink? I mean, really, you want to drink? I mean, I know I'm in AA, and I know I shouldn't offer you a drink, but for God's sake, that just looks, I mean, we've already offered you the steps, you didn't want them, you know, I mean, I will offer it to you again, you know, I mean, steps if you like, but you know, just not happy, they're just, right, and maybe you've had this experience, because I've had this experience, where maybe you did a perfect fifth step, and we're going to talk about the 10th step later, but maybe you've got this experience where you've cleaned everything completely. But then life has happened and there's been more blockage come back in. And you've got that angst back. Well, we have to be honest with someone if we expect to live long and happily in this world. But we think well before we choose the person with whom we're going to share this intimate and confidential step. Bottom middle of the page it says, we search our acquaintance for a closed-mouthed, understanding friend. We want somebody that's going to keep their mouth shut. Why? Well, you may think, if you're new, you may think, well, it's because I'm going to share some intimate stuff with them, and I don't really want my stuff on the street. And that's true. I believe that if you stay sober long enough, all of the stuff that you're afraid of not going on the street, you yourself will put on the street. You just will. You may do it, as I have done it from time to time. Almost everything in my story I've shared from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous in one way or another. Almost everything that was in my fifth step has shown up. There's a CD of it somewhere floating around. It's only bad when somebody who's heard it years ago comes up to you and reminds you of it. I'm really glad you shared about the goat. Oh. But certainly, if you don't share it from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll share it in a small group or one-on-one or with the guys and gals you sponsor, and somebody will say to you, hey, so-and-so's having the same problem as that thing you told me about. Do you mind if I share what you said with me? And you will say to them, no, you please go ahead. If that can be of any use to anybody, you go ahead and share that stuff. In fact, here, give them my number. If they want to talk to me, I'd be happy to help them any way that I can. And I don't believe you can be sober very long in Alcoholics Anonymous and have any secrets left. And when I say secrets, I mean anything left, really, that's just between you and your sponsor. Typically, there's several people who'll know all that stuff. So it's not that we do that. We look for a closed-mouth friend because if that stuff gets out, it can hurt us. It's something different. It's because when I'm new, I'm fragile and I don't know that yet. And when I'm new and I'm fragile and I don't know that yet, I might not tell you everything if I don't believe you'll keep a confidence. And if I don't tell you everything and I'm not honest with someone completely, I can't live long and happily. So I tell you this for kind of a backhanded reason. I bring this up because in my experience, the closed mouth part needs something that needs to be heard by the people who want to hear fifth steps. See, you might be somebody in your group that's popular, that has a silver tongue, and you share wonderfully, and everybody in your group wants you to be their sponsor, and they want help from you. You might be the person that, boy, you know, if only I had what Sheldon has. God forbid. Right? And they want to talk to you, but they know you're a little bit of a gossip. They've heard you at the home group. Do you hear what happened to Bill? Ah, boy. And you're saying it in a way where you kind of don't mean it to be bad, but you're putting Bill's stuff out on the street. And they've heard you say that. And then they come to you to do the fist stab, and they think, you know, Sheldon's a great guy. And I can tell him most of my stuff. But I remember he was telling me about Bill, and I don't want him telling Bill about me. So there's two cautionary tales here. One, if you're new and you're getting ready to share a fist step, or if you're not so new, but you're looking for the person to hear your fist step, what you need to do is you need to find someone who you will trust. That is more important than whether or not you believe they're going to have the insight to help you, because I promise you, God will show up at your fist step and inspire them and give them the insight. The magic is whether or not you trust them enough to be clear with them. That's the magic. Understanding. Why understanding? You know, by the time you get to AA, you've probably been called a putz by just about everybody in your life. And you probably need someone to be kind and loving and understanding. I don't know where I get this message. I gotta tell you, I've only ever been sponsored by Bob. Bob is a very gentle sponsor. Some reason, around 2 years sober, I decided to become a militant sponsor. I just thought that all the guys that I sponsored needed to be yelled at all the time for everything, and I just did. I did. I just became Sergeant Major Sheldon. They had to salute, and I went, "Up to you, get in line. What's the matter with you people?" And I don't know where you find that in the big book about Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know where you find that, but somehow I found that. And you know what happened is I went from being a guy that sponsored a lot of guys to a guy that didn't sponsor any guys. Because sponsorship is something that is by permission of the sponsee, not by permission of the sponsor. And you want to find someone that's going to be kind to you. Not kind to you to a fault. Not kind to you to tell you, don't pay your financial amends. I mean, that's a little... I don't think that's kind. I think that's cruel and self-serving, because they don't want to hurt your feelings, for crying out loud. But nice to you while they can. You know, there's a difference between rigorous honesty and brutal honesty. I want a sponsor that's going to be rigorously honest with me. I want my sponsor to tell me the truth. You know what the problem is with brutal honesty? It's brutal, right? And that's a problem, right? It's just got nothing to do with love and tolerance and AA and the way we try and teach each other to treat each other around here. So I want to find a closed-mouth, understanding friend. The bottom of the page, it's important that they be able to keep a confidence. We talked about that. They fully understand and approve of what we are driving at. It's a good idea to find somebody that has gone through this process. Now, the book talks about you don't have to. It clearly in the book, I don't argue with the book. The book says your doctor, your minister. It talks about all kinds of other people you can do your fist up with. I think that's a good idea if that's what drives you. I would always suggest that you find somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous who has done the process. And the reason that I believe that, there's an old joke, it's an old joke, you've heard the joke before, but what the heck, it's a good joke, I'm going to tell the joke. There's an old joke in Alcoholics Anonymous about the guy that's walking along the street and he falls in a hole. And he's in this really deep hole and the sides of the hole are really steep and he doesn't know how to get out. And he yells, "Help me, help me, help me." And this preacher walks by and the preacher looks down and he says, "Preacher, can you help me get out of the hole?" And the preacher writes a prayer on a piece of paper, throws a prayer in the hole, sends him the prayer, and walks on by. And he's still in the hole. And the doctor walks by and he says, "Doctor, doctor, can you get me out of the hole? I'm stuck in the hole. I need some help." And the doctor writes a prescription and throws a prescription down the hole and walks on by. And all of a sudden, the guy's still in the hole and he's got his prayer on a piece of paper and his prescription on a piece of paper. "Help me, help me, help me. Can you get me out of the hole?" And an AA member that's seen him at the local group sees him down the hole and he looks in the hole and goes, "Hey, man, can you help me out?" And the AA member jumps in the hole. And the guy says, "What are you doing? Now we're both stuck in the hole." He says, "Don't worry. I've been in this hole before. I know the way out. Follow me." And when I did my fifth step, I learned things about me in this process that I don't think someone that was hearing an inventory like a confession could have done for me. I think my sponsor had some insight that enabled me to see some things and learn some things about me and the world and my possible relationship with God that someone without his experience, it would have been impossible for me to see and get and learn those things from that person. What if you're a member of a religious body that requires confession? I think you should do that. I think there's a couple of alternatives for you to do that with. There are, in most religious bodies, there are many people that are of the cloth that are also members of AA that can hear an inventory. If I was of that faith, and I'm not telling anybody what to do, I'm telling you what I think I would do. I think I would share my inventory with my sponsor. And then I think I would also share it with a person of the cloth because I need to satisfy my religious leanings and I also need to get the insight that I can get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would never suggest to miss out on either of those. I would not suggest to anyone that has a religious yearning to miss out on his or her religious earning, but I wouldn't suggest either that you miss out on the insight that a sponsor that's been on this program can do, because here's what can happen. Now, you correct me if I'm wrong. Please do it privately, not in fact, don't correct me if I'm wrong. I like being wrong sometimes, but I don't know much about the Catholic faith. My wife is Catholic, and I know a little bit about it from her, but she's not really a practicing Catholic, so what she's told me might be wrong too, right? But I doubt it, because she is always right, so that's what she tells. Anyway, so what she tells me is that if you go to confession in the Catholic faith, when you confess the stuff to the priest, what he's going to do is probably give you some prayers to do, some meditation, some rosary, a little penance or whatever, and then he's going to tell you you're forgiven. And then you're forgiven. And so he might say you don't need to do steps 8 and 9 because, you know, gosh, God forgave you, so who cares if they do or not? Because you're forgiven. And you should do confession on a regular, consistent basis. Now, I was born into the Jewish faith. I don't practice Judaism today, but I was born into the Jewish faith. In the Jewish faith, we don't pay retail for anything. So we have a once a year deal that we do after New Year and before the Day of Atonement. And we have in the period between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we have a period of time where we contemplate the sins that we've done, and then on Yom Kippur we don't eat for a day, which doesn't sound like a big deal unless you're a Jew, and we like to eat, and so not eating for a day. We eat like the Irish drink. I mean, so not eating for a day is a big deal for us, but we don't eat. And then you take some bread, and you go to a stream or a river, and you pray some prayers over the bread, and you crumble it into crumbs, and you contemplate the sins, and you sprinkle them in the stream or the river, and the stream of the river carries them out of your sight, taking with you the sins. Which is a great, beautiful idea, except that a lot of Jews live in Israel. Israel's a desert. There aren't a lot of rivers or streams. So we had to come up with another way that isn't a river or stream way. So what they would do is they would get a sacrificial lamb or goat, and they would sprinkle the breadcrumbs on the head and the body of the goat, right? Say the prayers, and then they would slap the goat's ass. The goat would run out of the village and take with it your sins, which is good unless slapping a goat is on your fifth step to begin with, and then you're caught in this trap. It's like a wheel that you never, ever, ever... So, they should fully understand and approve of what you're driving at, and that he will not try to change your plan. And obviously your plan, hopefully, is that the next thing you're going to do is a 6 and 7, take an 8-step list and begin the practice of the 9-step. When we decide who's to hear our story, we waste no time. We have written an inventory and are prepared for a long talk. How long? I don't know. My 5th step, I can guess because I did it a while ago. We did it in 2 sections, probably 5 or 6 hours. Typically, it seems that that's about what they seem to take. It's about 5 or 6 hours. But I've done some that have been a lot shorter. I've done some that have been a lot longer. They take what they take, depending on what the guy shows up that has written it. But I'm going to tell you, it's going to be a lot. Even if it's only a half an hour, it's going to be a long talk if it's your inventory. But we're prepared for a long talk. He should realize that we are engaged in the life and death era. The person that is hearing your 5th step should realize that. Most people approaching this way will be glad to help. They'll be honored by our confidence. I got to tell you, I learned a lot about me in my 5th step. I got a lot of relief in my 5th step. I would say for the first time in my life in my 5th step, I was really what these promises say. I was able to look the world in the eye. It says, we park it upright and illuminate every twist of character. Once we have taken this step withholding nothing, we are delighted. I was delighted. We can look the world in the eye. And I could. I quit looking at my shoes. I started to feel like a member of the human race. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but we now begin to have a spiritual experience. And this is true for me. You know, remember I told you that when I did step 2, I didn't believe in God. I was willing to act as if God existed, but I didn't believe in God. When I took my 3rd step, nothing had changed. I didn't believe in God, but I was willing to put my life in the hands of the direction of my sponsor and act as if maybe God existed. But by the time I come out of my 5th step, I'm not plugged in completely. And we'll talk more about my struggles with spiritual things in 6 and 7 and 11. But I have, for the first time in my life, started to get a sense that really it's possible that there might be a God. Really, it's possible. But I got to tell you, the most benefit I have ever gotten out of step 5 is by hearing them, not by giving them. It's by hearing them, not by giving them. And I got great effect out of my 5th steps. But there is something magical and amazing that happens when you hear a 5th step. And you, for the first time, you know, in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, we try to share as honestly as we can. But it gets sugar-coated. It gets a little canned. You open yourself to a lot of judgment. But when you're sitting with a guy and he's sharing with you for the first time that raw, emotional, squirmy, embarrassing, pathetic, terrified stuff, and he's doing it in an intimate way, and he's terrified to share it with you because he's afraid of your reaction, and you see in his eyes you. And you know that that's how you feel. That's how you felt, and that's how you're going to feel again. And for the first time, you might really, really fall in love with another one of God's kids. Fall in love with another one of God's kids that doesn't have any money they can give you, doesn't have any influence they can wield over you. You know, probably you've got no sexual desire towards, right? That there's nothing that they can do for you, and you want nothing from them other than to help them. And they've trusted you with this, and you've done this journey with them together. And something else happens. When I'm sharing my stuff with you, I can't help but be a little defended. When I'm sharing my stuff with you, I can't help but have my ego a little bit engaged where I don't want you to think it's quite that bad. Where I don't want you to think, well, let me tell you about this, but
Before I tell you this, let me tell you this, because I want you to understand that, because soon I'm going to tell you this other thing, and if you didn't know the other story, you might think I was crazy, right? I mean, there's some of that in it when I'm sharing my stuff with you. But I'm not defended against your stuff when you're sharing it with me. And I think to myself, I'm doing this. I got my sponsor look. This is it right here. I like to sit 90 degrees from you because I think this is my best side. This side is not bad, but I think this is my best side. Right? And while you're talking, I go, And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God. I was thinking that yesterday. Holy cow. My God, I was going to do that when the fifth step was over. I probably have an amends to make for that too. I wonder if that's blocking me from God. I'm glad God removed that from me. I used to feel that way. I feel that way sometimes, but not as much anymore. God's really powerful. Oh my God, this guy's breaking my heart. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's going to be okay. I'm one of the herd. I belong here. We're going to make it. What an amazing, amazing piece of business that happens for me when I'm receiving a fifth step. What an amazing thing. There's no break on the schedule here, but we're going to take one anyway. We'll take a 10-minute break. Let's be back here at 4:35.